Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Adam Ragusea in for Anthony Brooks.
Oh, Nelly! Is it getting hot in here? I swear I haven't heard that in, like, years.
Well, it's actually 10 years old, if you can believe it. This was the song of the summer in 2002. And I actually bought this CD, you know, Nellyville.
Mm-hmm.
And I gotta say, I really don't want it anymore. In fact, I want it out of my house. So, Meghna, you wanna buy it?
How much?
Well, I guess I got it for 15 bucks. It's a little scratched up at this point, so let's say 5.
Done. I threw a wish in the well. Don't ask me, I'll never tell. Adam.
I love this song!
No, that's the thing. I so do not. At least not anymore. And after hearing it, I don't know, like a gajillion times this summer, I'm so sick of it. So, you want to buy it?
How much?
Well, let's see. I got mine off iTunes for $1.29, so, I don't know, 79 cents?
You got it.
Insert Redigi, the online marketplace where you can store, stream, buy, and sell pre-owned digital music. Just as your old CDs and records have a resale value in the secondary market, so do your MP3s.
Now, Redigi is a Cambridge-based startup, and here's how their product works. It verifies that your MP3s were legally obtained, that they weren't pirated, and then it uploads them to the cloud. And when you sell an MP3 to someone else, it scans your computer to make sure you don't have it anymore, so there's only one copy of the song. There's just one problem. Redigi is being sued by Capitol Records. They say it's copyright infringement. So joining us now is Mark Fisher. He's a partner at the Duane Morris firm here in Boston. He also teaches copyright law at Suffolk University. He's not representing Capitol Records in this case, but he's kindly agreed to articulate their point of view for the sake of argument here today. Mark Fisher, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks very much for inviting me.
And playing the part of Redigi's attorney, even though he's not really, is Jonathan Reichman, partner at Kenyon & Kenyon in New York. He also works in copyright law. Jonathan Reichman, thanks for joining us.
Hi, thank you.
So let's see. Mark Fisher, we'll start with you. We're all familiar with peer-to-peer file sharing at this point. You get your Napster, your LimeWire, your BitTorrent, Pirate Bay, all of questionable legality, to say the least. But the important difference with Redigi is that in theory, at least, it's not multiplying songs. It's essentially transferring ownership of a single copy. At least that's the intent. So what's wrong with that?
Well, representing the record companies, which is sure to win a popularity contest
these days,
call it illegal maybe, like the song. The copyright law did not anticipate being able to sell a copy of a digital file the same way you can legally sell a copy of a book or a DVD, which is completely legal. Lawyers call it the first sale doctrine. So the law didn't anticipate it.
Explain the first sale doctrine.
It means if you buy a physical object in buying a copyrighted work, like a book you buy at a bookstore, if you go to a bookstore now, and give it to a friend, sell it, you can burn it. You can do almost anything you want with that physical copy of a book, except make copies of that book or make a movie based on that book. But the physical object is yours to do pretty much anything you want with. The question in this case is for a digital file, which is rather different. Can you do the same thing? And that's what these people are claiming. And the copyright law doesn't anticipate it. The Copyright Office said in 2001 it doesn't believe that this kind of activity is legal. And what the company wants to do is they want to rewrite copyright law by saying if they can somehow erase all of your copies that you may have made from your digital file, it's okay to sell. The law doesn't anticipate it. I think the record company's view is that it's a brand new situation. And they want to shut it down. And money drives it, of course. And for the record companies and for artists, they share something, which is, like it or not, believe it or not, the recorded music industry is in deep trouble. Artists are literally starving. They can't get careers going. They can't get signed. And you can say that's a good thing because record companies are viewed as evil. But the effect of diminishing the incentive to create work by diminishing copyright status has hurt our popular culture. You have more music, but you can't hear it. And that may be a good thing because we have many, many different musicians, but it's hard to get distribution. But so if you remove the incentive to, and this incremental income by being able to sell two copies of an MP3 instead of just one when it's sold for like 69 cents through the service, that does reduce the income of the record company. Now, you can say that's okay. but it does have an effect.
But that's the key distinction. Assuming that Redigi's product works, and that's a big assumption I'm acknowledging, I'm stipulating, there won't be two copies where once there was one. You'll be transferring a copy from one place to another. Jonathan Reichman, is that, do I have it right?
Yes, and you know, I think Mark is absolutely correct that the most salient issue here is the first sale doctrine and how that applies to new technologies. Just to further support what Mark was saying, you know, so much of copyright law was rooted in old technologies. The current Copyright Act really goes back to 1909 and was replaced in 1978, but it's continually had to play catch-up with new technologies. You can go back to Xerox machines in the 1960s, of course the Sony Betamax case in the 1980s. And here you have a situation where I think, for, you know, if I were arguing, you know, Redigi's case, I would say that from a policy standpoint, from an economic standpoint, the first sale doctrine is being adhered to, because even if technically Redigi is making a copy in terms of transferring the music file from one computer to another, assuming the system works as they say and it gets deleted from the seller's computer, the economic result of the first sale doctrine is adhered to. In other words, the seller can't continue to enjoy or resell the music. You have the seller's copy, in effect, being destroyed, and it's now transferred. There's now one replacement copy, and it's going to the buyer. So the goals, the objectives of the first year sale doctrine are respected and adhered to.
We're talking about the Cambridge company Redigi, which allows you to resell your unwanted MP3s. Listeners, do you think that you should be able to resell your unwanted digital music like an old record? Or in the new landscape of digital media, is that a violation of copyright right up there with Napster and BitTorrent? And do you think a company like Redigi could hurt musicians by depressing sales if it's possible to hurt them any more than most of them have already been hurt? Give us a call, 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Mark Fisher, first sale doctrine. Why is the second sale not in keeping with the intent of the first sale doctrine? I've paid my money.
Well, I think that's the right question to ask because hi, Jonathan in New York. we're not going to resolve the legal issue, which is very arcane. Mm-hmm. So I think the real question is, when you ask, is should it be legal?
I see.
Part of this, oddly enough, depends on the end user agreement, the one that you click through anxiously to get the new version of iTunes and never read.
And I read it all the way through, I swear, every time.
You are the only one.
Yeah.
What does it say?
I have no idea.
But iTunes does not prohibit this kind of behavior. In other words, reselling your file. Amazon does. Apple could, in effect, add one sentence to its end user agreement, and if they follow it, they're not going to be able to resell the iTunes files, which is a really interesting aspect. But the question is, should it be covered by the first sale doctrine or not? Should you be able to sell your quote-unquote used, slightly worn, slightly frayed MP3 file? And it really comes down to money again. Is it better for the record industry to be able to capture that, or is it better policy for consumers to have the ability to freely sell MP3s? And I think the other thing you said that's really quite right is, how do you really know if all the copies have been destroyed?
Sure, but that's probably a conversation for another day with Redigi after they're out of this litigation, and we'll talk to us in greater detail than they're willing to talk to us today. Jonathan Reichman, though, I feel like Mark Fisher hints at an important argument, which is that, you know, if I want to sell you my bicycle, my used bicycle, it's going to be worth a lot less than it was than the day that I rode it out of the store. On the other hand, a digital copy that I'm selling you is pristine. There's no degradation of quality over its lifetime that it spends in my hard drive. So there's no incentive then for someone to pay the extra money to get a fresh new copy of Carly Rae Jepsen's hot new single, right?
Yeah, sure. I see that argument. That is somewhat of a disconnect between traditional first sale doctrine, you know, and this technology. You know, with a book or a you know, video cassette, you know, in terms of extensive application of the first sale doctrine over time, the copy that the consumer sells and then gets resold and resold again, it degrades over time. So it doesn't have an infinite lifespan, and it's never in the same pristine form as the original at the time it was first purchased. Certainly in the digital world, you know, that concept, that degradation gets thrown out the window. So from an economic standpoint, that does hurt the record companies, and I can completely understand why they're up in arms about this. But, you know, like so much of copyright law, it's an economic balance between the rights of the owners and the rights of the users. It's built into the U.S. Constitution, where copyright law is recognized as affording creators a monopoly power, but for limited time. Mm-hmm. So you have, you know, going back over 200 years, the need to balance these economic interests.
Let's take a call from a music consumer. David is calling from Lowell. Hi, David.
Hi, how are you?
What's your take on Redigi?
I think that it's a perfectly legitimate business, because I don't think that musicians would really see too much of a decrease in their sales, because most people, if they're most people who would pirate would most likely not use the service, so you wouldn't see much of a decrease. And also, it's my own property. I bought it with my money. It's something I can do with it, and it's perfectly legal to sell a physical copy of that of a CD, for example. So there's really no precedence on why it should be illegal to sell a digital copy if it's essentially the same thing.
I'll take the point, David. Mark Fisher, you seem to be sort of arguing for, if we accept the analogy, let's just stipulate the analogy between a digital copy of something and a physical of copy. Let's just take that as a granted for the sake of argument. If that's the case, then you seem to be arguing for really an expansion of copyright privilege on the part of digital content providers. And I'm looking here at Harvard Law Professor Lewis Hyde's fantastic book on this stuff, Common as Air. And let me read a little excerpt from this. He's saying, take, for example, an electronic book publisher's recent offering of Lewis Carroll's 1865 Alice's Adventures in Wonderland. The copyright notice carried the following warnings. No text selection can be copied from the book to the clipboard. No printing is permitted of this book. The book cannot be lent to someone else. The book cannot be given to someone else. This book cannot be read aloud. There's got to be a limit at some point here, right?
Well, authors have put all sorts of notice in books. Mark Twain once said that the person who copied should be shot in a book. You know, again, this is all about incentive. And you know, Dave and Lowell raises a really great point, and that's very fair. But as the labels diminish, a lot of the music on iTunes and Amazon is from individual artists. Yeah. You know, we've been pushing the do-it-yourself philosophy. Well, artists are having to do that. So you're taking money away from the artist. You can argue that consumer power is more important than incentivizing artists, and that's one way to look at it. But if you take away money from labels and artists, you will have fewer artists who can be full-time professional musicians, and they'll become hairdressers and lawyers and accountants and radio hosts. And
hey,
you can, and this is, you know, we're pushing people out of professional music, and that's an effect. And I think Dave raises a perfectly fair point of view, but you are making it easier for consumers to save money, which is of course valuable, but it's there is an effect, there is a consequence to depriving musicians and labels of their sources of income. And that's just the question, who should get it? But, you know, again, the law is not clear at this point.
Jonathan Reichman, assuming that standing copyright law, first use, first sale law doesn't apply to digital copies of music or books or what have you, what do you think would be an appropriate regulatory regime for protecting the rights of the copyright holders?
Well, I think, you know, there are already several regimes built into the copyright law. You know, there are potentially compulsory license systems. You know, I think a model, an economic model, can be developed around this. And another option is for Congress to update the copyright law. And I think as a result of so many copyright law battles going on right now on so many different fronts, the Cablevision case, the YouTube case, I think there's a lot of impetus right now for an updating of this Copyright Act, which, you know, in its current form was enacted in 1978, to be brought up to speed from the technological front. So that's the type of resolution that I think we really need at this point.
I think the comment made earlier may be the most important, which is I think the world is much more divided between legal purchasers and people just take music for free, which is a pretty good price point. My guess is, and I have no idea what the economic model is, that the market for people who want to pay 69 cents instead of 99 cents or $1.29 will go to the trouble of having their hard drive scrubbed of other copies and go into the system is a really small group of people. And I do think the real battle, and I guess it is a battle, is between free, piratical, or unauthorized copies, to put it more nicely, and legal distribution, as opposed to this legally, for copyright lawyers, this is really fascinating.
I bet.
But I think it's a lot of work to do it. I mean, wouldn't people go to BitTorrent rather than try to deal with this? It seems like a hassle, frankly.
Well, in our last couple of minutes that we have here, I do want to open up one possibility, which is that, I mean, in reading about ReDigi today, getting ready for this show, I thought of like five ways to get around the product, at least as it was, you know, as it's been presented to me. You know, you could put a file onto your iPod and stash it there, and then ReDigi will destroy the file off of your hard drive, what have you, and you can stash it back over. So, if you have, let's again, for the sake of argument, pretend that ReDigi is legal. What they're doing is legal, assuming that it works. If it's filled with so many holes that it's really, really easy to get around, could that be legal basis enough for a judge to step in and say, no more with this? Jonathan Reichman?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a possibility. One thing that a judge would look at from an equitable standpoint, you know, is how does it work? You know, is it easy to get around? If it's so easy to get around that it ultimately becomes unworkable, then I think a judge would weigh in that factor in terms of deciding whether a company like Capitol Records is entitled to relief.
Mark Fisher, you have the last thought.
I think it's all about who is more important here. Are the creators of music, the musicians, worth sustaining economically? And this is one very small case. It's like a law exam question. More importantly is, are we going to reward consumption or creativity? And we can't entirely go one way without affecting the other.
Mark Fisher is a partner at Boston's Duane Morris firm. He also teaches copyright law at Suffolk University Law School. Again, I want to reiterate that he's not representing Capitol Records in this case, but he was kind enough to sort of represent their point of view for the sake of argument and discourse on this show. Thank you so much, sir.
You're welcome.
And Jonathan Reichman, partner at Kenyon & Kenyon down in New York, where I should mention New York State is where this suit has been filed. He also works in copyright law. Jonathan Reichman, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Stay with us. Coming up, new music from bluesman James Montgomery that takes us from Detroit to the Delta. Stay with us. I'm Adam Ragusea with Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.